Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, committed to Mazda's focus to ensure every element of a car is designed around the driver. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. The theory behind integrating the public schools, aside from simple fairness, was that in an integrated environment, kids from different races and backgrounds would grow up together and begin to eradicate the stain of race that blanketed America. Charlotte led the way, successfully integrating its public schools to the point where it became a shining example of what that success could look like. It lasted until 1999, when Judge Robert Potter decided that CMS had achieved unitary status and that busing to achieve integration was no longer needed. The Supreme Court declined to hear the appeal of that case, and the school system was left to decide how to redo their assignment policy, resulting in the 2002 School Choice Plan. That plan may have brought choice back to the district, but it also resegregated the schools. Today, CMS is as segregated as it was before the 1971 decision that forced Charlotte to integrate its classrooms. Segregated schools help feed the feelings of racism that appear to be building across the country, and in Charlotte, at least, segregated schools add to the struggle we face here with economic opportunity. Most people don't like to talk about racism, but today we will, with four educators who are tackling this problem head-on, and we'll explore some of their suggested solutions. At least I hope they have some solutions. Tracy Benson is an assistant professor of educational leadership at UNC Charlotte and the author of Unconscious Bias in Schools, a developmental approach to exploring race and racism. Welcome to the program.
Well, thank you so much for having me.
You're welcome. He joins us in our Spirit Square studio along with everybody else. Janine Bryant is Director of Operations at CREED, the Center for Racial Equity in Education. Thank you for being here.
Good morning, Mike.
Earlene Lyde is back. She's former president of the Charlotte-Mecklenburg Association of Educators and a teacher at CMS for over 18 years. You've seen a lot.
I have. Thank you. Welcome.
Well, thank you. Welcome back. And Frank Barnes is here as well. He's the Chief Equity Officer at CMS. Thank you for joining us.
Thanks, Mike, for having me.
We're on the radio. We're on Facebook Live. And if you'd like to join the conversation, you can email us at charlottetalks@wfae.org. Search for WFAE on Facebook. Get to us through Twitter at Charlotte Talks. So, Frank, let me begin with you because you're the Chief Equity Officer right now at our public schools. When you look at the broad historical sequence of events in public education here, it appears that we had this problem handled at least pretty well. And then because of the court issue that I referenced, we backtracked. So at the time of the 1999 decision, CMS itself was telling the courts, no, we have not achieved unitary status. And yet the court ignored that and said, yes, you have, and set you free to do whatever you wanted to do. If Judge Potter had agreed with CMS and said, no, you haven't reached unitary status, the ruling stands, would it be correct to say that the racial divide that we see in our schools today would not exist?
It's hard to play Sunday morning quarterback with historical events. I think it was well chronicled that we hadn't achieved nirvana, if you will, that we hadn't conquered the ills and impacts of racism at the time. Where we are now is looking at exactly what you articulated, and it's not just in Charlotte, but it's across the country.
Sure.
Resegregated schools.
Because our case opened the door to everybody, just as it did the first time. We were the test case.
And I think given the instances, I agree with the conclusions of the administration and the community at that time that was asking for us to not be given unitary status. Nevertheless, given where we are today, I think we need to think about, given how we have our schools constructed, given the way housing is constructed in Charlotte, we as a community need to say, how do we provide great schools in every community, regardless of the concentration of different races or the concentration of poverty?
And why don't we?
I think if I'm saving that answer so that I can make lots of money for it. But I think overall what you're seeing is we're still dealing with the legacy of racism.
Right.
in our country. We're still dealing with bias and in some levels of injustice. And I think even in some instances, we're dealing with our industry of education, not North Carolina, not right. Charlotte, but our industry of education, which is trying to remedy the things that we did and trying to undo them and unlearn them while recreating schools that never existed for this level of demand before.
So in his decision ending busing for the purposes of integration, Judge Robert Potter wrote, "The court is convinced that CMS, to the extent reasonably," this is a quote, "the court is convinced that CMS, to the extent reasonably practicable, has complied with the 30-year-old desegregation order in good faith that racial imbalances existing in schools today are no longer vestiges of a dual system, and that it is unlikely that the school board will return to an intentionally segregated system." But we have resegregated.
And Mike, that's what I think we can't forget, is that that school board did return, and what they did in terms of gerrymandering of zoning for schools. And if you go back and look, I came here in 2001. Mm-hmm. The first year I was here, busing was still going on. But the set after that, it changed. And so what happened is that they started piecemealing those because of complaints, et cetera. They started squeezing zones and rezoning families to different areas than they were. And so that was part of the resegregating of our system.
Well, some historical perspective for people who have not lived here as long as we have lived here. When this court order came down and said you don't have to bus anymore, it came down because a parent of a student sued to have the system changed because they wanted to get their child into a magnet school and were turned down twice, they said, for racial quota reasons. And there was this movement back in those days for a pressing return to neighborhood schools and to choice schools. And at the time, some students here were being bused all over Hell's Half Acre to get to where they were going for school. You could live in Ballantyne and find yourself at Myers Park High School easily. And people wanted to be closer to home. That's a good thing, I think. But when the school system was unleashed to do what they had to do to respond to this, did they know what would be the result? I mean, they had to do it. Did they know the result would be what we're experiencing today, resegregated schools?
Well, I'll chime in on that one. And I think we have to understand what we're talking about is the Brown decision back from 54.
Right.
And integration was never the ask. It was never what the communities that were oppressed were seeking for. They were seeking for equal resources and equal opportunities. They weren't seeking integration. And so Charlotte chose the move of integration, assuming that it would produce equal education opportunity. But something we don't talk about is that just because we have black and brown students going to school with white students, that there wasn't tracking and segregation within schools. And in terms of educational opportunity, that still goes on today. That's what Rosalind Mixlin writes about in her book about Charlotte Mecklenburg schools, is about second generation segregation, that different educational experiences within the same integrated schools. And so getting back to your question about did the school district know that when the order was lifted for integration, would it go back to segregated schools? Well, the city's already has always been residentially segregated. And if you go back to neighborhood schools, of course the schools are going to be segregated. So it's illogical. These are very smart, well-educated people. And so anyone could predict that if you lift the order and people are involuntarily being bused, once you go back to voluntary choice, you're going to go back to segregation.
When we were fully integrated, prior to this ruling in the 90s, were students on an equal playing field? Were minority students doing as well as white students?
Because we know the caution that we
sure.
I don't know that we were ever fully integrated.
Okay,
we were desegregated.
Okay,
which is different. So we just want to add some nuance to our language.
Okay, so before we were resegregated,
right?
Let's put it that way. Were African American and Hispanic students who don't do as well right now, or maybe the system doesn't affect them as well as they do white students?
Right.
Was that the case then when we were fairly integrated?
Yes, it was, Mike, and that's why No Child Left Behind came along, because you were not getting the results for the subgroups in every school. So there was some masking of not being really responsive to the needs of those students who were struggling.
Has it gotten worse?
It has gotten more identifiable.
Mm-hmm. Is that a good thing or a bad thing? If we can identify a problem, it's easier to fix it, right?
Well, it depends upon who's trying to do the fixing, and that's what has happened in education is the wrong people have come in and said, this is how you fix it.
Who are the wrong people?
The wrong people are the corporatists and the people who want to run the schools as a business instead of looking at every school individually and saying, what can we do for this particular set of children in this particular school? And so that's why we people want it to go to the trough, the public trough, the money, all of this books and everything that, you want to script what happens in our high poverty schools, not script what's happening in your low poverty schools. So there's been a mindset here and a reckoning of, low expectations and discrimination, but let me sell you something for this testing thing and that sort of thing. And so what we have done is not looked at children and their needs, but we looked at, how can we create these tests and everything and mm-hmm. make some money.
Does it surprise you, given all the lawsuits that we went through from the 50s through the 70s into the 90s to integrate or to have equal schools, opportunity in schools, to back to neighborhood schools. Mm-hmm. Does it surprise you that the end result of this has not yet resulted, Janine, in a lawsuit to reverse it yet again?
I think what we see now is our to your point, I think we see a lot of what we always see in Charlotte. We see people hearkening back to private-public partnerships, an over-reliance on outside influences in our school system, and a lack of, quite frankly, a lack of courageous leadership to turn and face the issues that we see. And I would ask us to really think about the questions that Dr. Tracy Benson is raising in his book around those cultural biases, because I think we're going to start to see, and we don't, it's not just start to see, we've seen it. I've been here, I was an educator here in 2004 in the public school systems. I was watching the resegregation happen right in front of my eyes as a result of that lawsuit. So here we are 20 years later, we see a persistence of 20 years of growing inequity. So I think absolutely you're going to see that people are going to flag this. And right now we know that Leandro case is going to, and so that case that mandated what the experience for education experiences should happen for students. We know that we haven't hit those marks. We don't need any consultants to tell us that. We already know we haven't. So what are we going to do about it? And a lot of people are going to be pressing to see rapid action. Some of that action may happen in litigation.
Where does that courageous leadership that you talked about, where does that have to be placed? Is that at the school board level, at the superintendent level, at the city council, county commission, state government? Where does that have to be?
We're talking about comprehensive leadership change, I think. I don't think it's just district level leadership. I think North Carolina is looking at Charlotte is, I think, a great example of where you have to have parents, students, teachers, and district level administrators all holding hand and all facing the same direction. We know that's not what's happening in Charlotte.
Can that be achieved?
It absolutely can. We know Charlotte was a model for 41 other school districts.
Right.
We know it can happen. Unfortunately, that happened with a lot of pressure from litigation.
It should be noted here, for people who don't remember this, Ronald Reagan was running for president in 1984 when he came to Charlotte. And he mentioned at this campaign stop that he accused Democrats of wanting dependence of the state and not citizens. And he accused them of keeping people in bondage as wards of the state. And he used as an illustration to make that point the court-ordered integration of schools that seemed to inflame a lot of the South, but not here. And his words got absolutely dead silent response from the Charlottesians gathered there because we had done it. We had integrated the schools successfully. And the Observer headlined an editorial following that appearance with the statement, "You were wrong, Mr. President." When we come back, I want to get an answer if he was wrong, and that was one of our proudest achievements, what happened? We're going to come back in a moment at Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, committed to drivers that share Mazda's passion that cars make driving matter. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about the return to racially segregated schools in Charlotte, how we got here, and what the implications are, maybe what some of the possible solutions are, and also dealing with racism as an entity, not just racial segregation. Tracy Benson is here. He's an assistant professor of educational leadership at UNC Charlotte and the author of a book that outlines a lot of this, Unconscious Bias in Schools, A Developmental Approach to Exploring Race and Racism. Janine Bryant is director of operations for CREED, the Center for Racial Equity in Education. Erlene Lide, former president of the Charlotte-Mecklenburg Association of Educators and a CMS teacher for far too long. I don't know how you stood it. More than 18 years. And Frank Barnes, chief equity officer of CMS. I just told the Ronald Reagan story of him coming here in 1984 and his normal campaign line about school integration falling on deaf ears, essentially, and the Observer saying, "You were wrong, Mr. President." So that was, and the reason it fell on deaf ears is because we Charlottesians took, I think, justifiable pride in having integrated the school system, and we were the poster child for that. People came to us to ask us how we did it and could we help them do it. Boston, for instance, came to us, and they have a severe racial integration problem in Boston. So when we went back because of the court order in the late 90s, when we flipped, was that just because people wanted neighborhood schools? And we can now provide that opportunity because of the lack of a court order demanding busing. Or was there a racial component to that request?
There absolutely was a racial component, and you can't get away from that because some people did not want their children going to school with ethnic minorities. And you can see that as they've gone to private schools and charter schools. And that,
was this being that driven? We have a population in Charlotte that is, you know, people are coming here every day from elsewhere in the country where they didn't have the kind of success and they didn't accomplish what we had accomplished. Was this push for neighborhood schools with the racial undertones that you're talking about from newcomers, or was it people going, at last we can do it, we've been trapped here in Charlotte, now we can do something about it?
I think a lot of it was newcomers and what they had experienced in their own hometowns, but a lot of it was stirred up, too, mm-hmm. for the people who were living here. And so I think in terms of the leadership thing and that what we have to do is what drives change is grassroots.
Right.
And so we cannot look to the leaders to Superman. Superman is not coming. And so that's why we've got to go back to the communities and say, this is not right, and you have to rise up demand.
You were in the classroom as a teacher during this period of time, and Janine, you were in the classroom as a student during this part of time.
In 1984.
Oh, excuse me.
I was two.
You after the 1999 decision.
Oh, yes.
Okay.
I transitioned in 2004 to the classroom.
Okay, so you were there. So tell me what you see as the impact of that decision on students in the classroom.
Yeah, it's interesting that you framed it that way because I actually was a student in 1999 and I was transitioning into college at Davidson, and we competed in high school. In South Carolina, we knew the names of the top high schools in Charlotte. We knew them. We knew them as competitive. We knew them as merit scholars. And so for us, Charlotte represented a national reputation around academic achievement and success. And that was for every student we encountered. They were forensics champions and great athletic systems. So we knew Charlotte as a top competitive district. Once I got here, and within that short 4-year time period, by the time I transitioned into a CMS classroom, I was witnessing, literally witnessing West Charlotte resegregate. And so within 4 years after that Capiccioni case, so that mandate, once we saw the lack of leadership around like what other alternative plans we could do, I saw the school resegregate.
So what was the impact of that?
Long-term impact is that we saw exacerbations of almost every indicator of racial inequality and disparity that you would want to see, that you would want to see countered. We saw a reduction in student achievement. We saw a reduction in graduation rates. We saw a higher rate of suspension in our schools. We saw more disciplinary touch for objective measures. We saw an increase in novice teachers in the classrooms. All of those indicators are what we saw. And then we talk about a 20-year persistence in economic disparity. I link that directly to our educational experience.
So the whole reason for the 1954 Supreme Court decision that resulted in integrating the school system was that separate but equal was not working. They were separate and not equal. Are we together but not equal today?
Right, and I think on her point, what you saw was the people, fewer and fewer people being able, advocating for those schools that were being changed. I was at E.E. Waddell High School, and a part of our problem was that people wanted to go to South Meck. They wanted their children to go to Myers Park. And so what I saw happening is that they kept taking pieces of neighborhoods and pieces of neighborhoods until they ended up with mostly black and brown children. And then the resources started being squeezed, nobody to advocate for them. That school should have never been closed, but they did not have the advocacy in the community to keep it going. And so that's what's happening to all of our other high poverty schools also.
So Janine was talking a moment ago about when this happened. One of the results was we saw more disciplinary problems and suspensions, and we saw changes in test scores, et cetera. And that kind of plays into your book, Tracy, because that is racism. That's unnoticed, what do you call it, implicit racism or unconscious bias. Title of your book, in the foreword of your book, the founder of an education group writes that, quote, schools cannot achieve racial equity without explicitly naming race and exposing racism as central in the failure to effectively serve the student groups that comprise the majority of the school population. How difficult a task is that?
Well, thank you for that question, Mike. And I think we have to bring this back to the greater context of black people in the United States, that 2019 marks the 400th year of the transatlantic slave trade. Mm-hmm. So starting in 1619 until 1865, black and brown people were enslaved to this country, were not allowed to be literate, were not allowed to be educated. This is 246 years, generation after generation of undereducation. And then after that, we had 89 years of Jim Crow segregation, where it was still legal to discriminate against black and brown people. So if we're talking 345 years of legalized discrimination against black and brown people, and if we count 1965, the Civil Rights Movement, as the end of legalized discrimination, we're only at the 55-year mark, opposed to 345 years of legalized discrimination, which includes undereducation of black and brown populations. So every action deserves an equal and opposite reaction in order to solve that. So if we don't focus specifically on how these vestiges of racism and the legacy of racism still affects us today, we're never going to achieve what we expect to achieve in educators.
There's a lot of conversation when Barack Obama became president that we were now living in a post-racial society, and we quickly discovered that wasn't the case. And in the Trump years, we have discovered that there's this rise or unleashing or freedom to express some feel of white nationalist feelings. When you take those people out of the equation, the extremists, and you just put it on the population at large, is what we're witnessing here when we talk about racism, is it a black-white thing, or is it more of an economic social thing? We live in two separate worlds, and when our worlds collide, we're uncomfortable because they are different worlds. Not that you're black and I'm white, but that we come from different backgrounds with different customs, essentially, different linguistics, different forms of dress. Is that the problem?
So, I mean, we have this the myth, especially in Charlotte, that it's the outsiders coming in and affecting what happens here in Charlotte. I mean, I'm not from Charlotte, but my wife is from Charlotte. Her parents are from Charlotte. We have the long lineage of folks from Charlotte in my in-law family. And racism was here long before the integration, and that we think that that segregation is normal. It's not. We talk about it as if it's normal. Like residential segregation is normal. That has everything to do with economic class. But even when economics is not not a part of the question, when you level the playing field and compare low-income blacks and low-income whites and low-income Latinos, they're still segregated.
Absolutely.
So it is a race and racism thing. So it's not a natural occurrence, but we talk as if it's natural, and it comes from our long legacy and history of racial discrimination, and that legacy holds true today. Unless we talk about it very specifically, why my white child does not want to go to this black school in those terms, we can never come to the real reasons why racism is at the
And Mike, I want to build on something that Tracy said earlier. He eloquently and swiftly articulated this 400-year legacy of racism. And imagine that racism is equivalent of the gravitational pull. What we've been, what we were doing during that short period of time since Brown to today, or even to 1999, was trying to escape the gravitational pull of racism's legacy in the United States. And it's going to have to be a consistent effort. It's just because we exercise more, say, jet propulsion, equity-based education, culturally responsive teaching, it doesn't eliminate the gravitational pull of racism, inequity, and that we're always seeking to escape. Mm-hmm. So when a decision was made, it was the natural system saying we're going to retract back to what has always been. So I don't think it's a confluence of everything you've talked about. Those who are residents, those of us who are now transplants and have called Charlotte home, it's been part of our national legacy.
Right.
So even as we're looking at where we are today in the Charlotte-Mecklenburg schools, we're still working to undo what was done with greater vigor, but even more complexity because of the economic growth and the larger diversity of 7 municipalities in one county.
We are as segregated today in our schools as we were prior to these court decisions. So would you say it's been one step forward and 2 steps back?
I think sometimes we might say 2 steps would be generous. It might be 3 steps back at times. But I think every time we've been pushing, I look back at some of the great things that Dr. Pugley did, Dr. Eric Smith did, Dr. Gorman did. I think there's things that every superintendent and every board has done to help us take steps forward.
Right.
But we're not always consistently building on those steps. And as Janine articulated, making this more than just a school district, but being system community partnerships, teacher administration partnerships, working with our universities. I don't think we've always done a great job of building on what is the community vision and community desire.
I absolutely agree.
Go ahead.
Well, I think we can build on that whole idea, that metaphor you were using around the gravitational pull, because it's, and I like that you're using, you know, pluralistic language. This is not, I don't think it's only a black and white issue. I think it has a lot to do with us being willing to explicitly name, to use language that explicitly named racism, and then countering that in all of the ways in which we tackle our system dynamics, because really the system is implicated here. And so if you see something as built into the system, just as Dr. Benson said, if you see undereducated populations, you see legal discrimination, you'd have to name it explicitly if you're trying to counter that. And in our report for Creed, the Erasing Inequities report, we explicitly name and isolate. If you isolate race and you start look at the other factors, we know that what the outcomes are going to be. We can predict the outcomes based on children's race. That's all over North Carolina. And as you said, it's actually exacerbated all over the country. We've got to do something to explicitly name it if we're going to tackle
it. This idea of naming it is throughout your book. The fact that you say we need to talk about it. We need to name it. We need to have discussions about it. It needs to be out in the open. It's uncomfortable as hell, and we got to do it. So how do you do it?
Well,
and why is that the school's this is a societal problem. This is not an education problem.
Yeah.
It's a societal problem. So why is it the school's job to do
it? It is a societal problem, and it's something where we have to understand that everyone who has a professional job, everyone sitting in this room, everyone who probably works at the studio has been through our schools. And schools are a great place as a starting place for one to tackle racial inequities and to create racially literate students. So the reason we have racially illiterate adults who can't talk about race and racism in open ways is because in schools we're taught that it's taboo.
Right.
Teachers don't talk about race and racism. Students may talk about it among one another, but we're taught that most of the time that talks about race and racism in schools is taboo. And so we go through a lifetime of being and not being taught how to talk about race and racism through our schools. And so when we become adults, hence it carries on this particular legacy.
Where would you start that conversation?
So this conversation right now, having this conversation at Charlotte Talks is of course one place. And like I said, you know, it's only been 55 years since black and brown people have been like legally free from discrimination. That's arguable. But, you know, we're gonna have to keep these conversations going for not just next year, the year after, for decades and decades, to push it forward so we can really bring to the front how racism plays a role in our society.
Prior to Jim Crow, and certainly through Jim Crow, I think racism could be defined as hatred of black people, or at least overt discrimination against black people. Following the end of Jim Crow, the 65 Civil Rights Act, and onward, that racism has simmered in an undercurrent that we don't talk about, which is what you're talking about. We need to talk about it to get it out in the open. Has the nature of racism changed? Is it really?
It's systemic.
Is it deliberate or is it simply unconscious? We've solved it, but we haven't.
It went into hiding until the current president uncovered all the rocks, because in terms of unconscious bias, you've got to get people talking about what happens when I see someone who doesn't look like me coming up to me. What happens in that conversation? In schools, what we've got to do is say, what are you teaching your child, this child, like you would teach a child, a white child of another race? What are the unconscious biases that you have brought forth into educating children, even though they may be you might be saying, I'm not a racist. But some of the ways you might respond to certain events and culturally and so forth and so on, we've got to have those conversations among educators. And we do, and we got to talk about also trauma and poverty and how they affect what's going on with kids. But the unconscious biases, we need training to do that. And there are some good programs out there, and your book really has helped people start to have those. And we, but is it system-wide? Is it even in a low-poverty school, you've got to sit those educators down and say, when that kid comes into your classroom, what are you feeling, what are you experiencing, how are you directing what you do as an educator?
So Frank Bart, you're the Chief Equity Officer at CMS. Did these discussions take place?
They take place in some of our equity work on literally a daily basis. I think what we are grappling with
whom?
It takes place with teachers, it takes place with administrators, it takes place with our equity team, and we have these explicit conversations. And I think part of the nature of how things are different, say, from Jim Crow, is that what we have to grapple with is that there are sometimes race-neutral conditions or race-neutral practices that have racialized disparate impacts on students and families. I don't think it's always a pernicious, intentious effort to do something to a group of people in all instances, but we have to be able to talk about, get away from these biasms of non-racist, but really start talking about how do our work impact people in different ways.
A lot of the problem is here is unrecognized racism. We're going to talk about some things that may be examples of that that probably haven't occurred to a lot of people, or maybe they have. We'll find out when we come back at Charlotte Talks on WFAE. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking with Tracy Benson, author of Unconscious Bias in Schools, A Developmental Approach to Exploring Race and Racism. He's an assistant professor of educational leadership at UNC Charlotte. Janine Bryant, director of operations at CREED, the Center for Racial Equity in Education. Frank Barnes is the chief equity officer for Charlotte-Mecklenburg Schools. And Earlene Lyde is a former president of the Charlotte-Mecklenburg Association of Teachers and a teacher at CMS for more than 18 years. Before I talk about one of the things I was going to bring up as an example of unconscious bias, let me read some emails that have come in while we've been talking. Jeremy on Facebook, empowering parental choice in education produces the best results. Unfortunately, it leaves behind those who cannot or will not make informed, empowered educational choices for their children. Reaction.
There's a lot of people on Facebook that like to use code words. And so when we see things like choice and we want to have school options, what they're really pointing to is this redirection to charter school experiences, private vouchers, or any ways in which we can privatize the educational experience. I mean, that's not what we're talking about here today.
I know, but that was going to be one of my next questions, because the state of North Carolina raised the cap on the number of charter schools, and that has allowed more charter schools to come into existence, and all the charter schools are, quote, public schools, unquote. The money is coming from CMS to support those charter schools, and they have to take everybody, I understand. Has that?
No, they don't have to.
They don't have to take?
No.
But do they lead, have they exacerbated the resegregation of the public schools, and is that why they exist in your mind?
Once they raised, when charter schools came out, they were actually to be incubators of what practices could be transferred to the public schools.
Has that turned out to be the case?
No.
Why?
What has happened is once they eliminated the caps, then the focus became, how do I get my kids out of public schools but still not have to pay private school money?
But there are majority black and brown charter schools.
There are, but they were there before the caps were lifted. But they, if you notice also, they have not been supported as much as they were before.
Okay. Mike emails, is it racist to want a quality education for one's children? Do blacks who send their children to private schools have a bias against blacks in public schools? Charlotte City Council, Charlotte Mecklenburg School Board, Mecklenburg County Commission, and city and school leadership is black. Charlotte and Mecklenburg are majority white. Where is the racism?
So what we have to understand about how racial bias works is that we've been raised in a highly racially biased society. We're exposed to it on a daily basis, mm-hmm. from television, from news stories, even at the grocery store, about the faces that we see in marketing and advertising. It's that we live in a very white-centric society. And so this idea that black and brown people don't have ingested racial bias is simply false, because we're all raised in the same society. Mm-hmm. And so if I have, as an African-American male, have racial biases that I've ingested about black and brown people, of course white people do also. And this harkens back to the Kenneth and Mamie Clark study back in the 1950s about the doll study with the black and white dolls with kids who are as young as five, that when you give kids, regardless of race, a choice between a black doll and a white doll, overwhelmingly they choose the white doll because society has taught them that whiteness is good. Whiteness is the center of what's normal. And blackness, even that young, is not as good as whiteness. So we've ingested this from a very, very young age. And so in terms of racial biases, it plays out among all of us
that we need to talk about. Is this particular to the United States, or that would you find this in other majority white Western nations?
I've heard that the United States, our greatest export is white supremacy and these persistence of ideas of this racialized hierarchy. I think in Charlotte we have a unique situation in that a lot of people are very conscious of a racialized hierarchy. They're very conscious of even of their implicit bias. People have gone through trainings. They've gone to do things that uncover their own biases. They take the Harvard implicit bias test online, and they're very aware of it. However, I think it makes it more difficult to counter and constantly interrogate your bias when you believe that you are aware of it and that you've done something to counter it simply by taking a training. And so we have to, I think as Tracy's indicating, we have to constantly interrogate our behavior. We have to be willing to look at the system level. So I want to give a couple of examples of systems level thinking, because I think a lot of people think about race and they're still thinking about interpersonal racism. They're thinking about whether or not you called me the N-word. Mm-hmm. That's not what we're talking about. Systems level outcomes and access to honors courses. We know that students of color do not have access to AIG and honors courses. So even if they are fully capable, those courses won't be taught in their schools. We know that. We know that overwhelmingly students of color will not be taught by teachers of color. And we know that that plays into culturally relevant bias. We know that overwhelmingly that 80% of our teachers in North Carolina are white. So we're not necessarily saying this is explicit, intentional racism. No one's running through classrooms or schools telling black students that they're incapable. I also offer us to be really careful about conflating race and poverty, because you can even isolate and take poverty out of the equation, and you will still find racialized outcomes for students of color.
So many questions. A white teacher can't teach a black child?
That's not at all what I said. I said is that overwhelmingly in North Carolina, our teachers are white, and of those overwhelmingly white teachers, they are women. And we know through lots of research and data that a student's experience of a teacher that reflects their history, background, and culture, mm-hmm. can have a very positive outcome. Now, if we already know that overwhelmingly the teachers do not reflect the culturally relevant and responsive background, then we already know that there's going to be some kind of disparity unless somebody does actively counters it.
If 80%, if we know that 80% of the teachers in North Carolina are white and most of them are women, and we know that black children may have a better outcome with somebody who culturally understands them and whom, with whom they can relate, be that a black man or a black woman, how much can schools anywhere do about that if the majority of the teachers available to the school system to hire are white?
I think that analogy is going a little too far.
All right.
Because I've known great teachers and great white teachers, and all they need is the help to understand what they are bringing to it. If you help them understand that you did this because of maybe some unconscious bias, et cetera, then they will seek to grow and they will seek to educate themselves. And that's what I have found as the Association of Educators.
So give me an example. Give me an example of that, because if it's unconscious bias, that's difficult to self-diagnose. It's unconscious. You don't know you have it. So give me some examples of how to recognize it, or who would help you recognize it without getting your defenses up. Because that just puts barriers up and you're not going to do anything about it. So give me some examples of how that presents, how we would recognize it, and how we would solve it.
So something that we talk about and talk about somewhat in the book and also in different talks is that where there's smoke, there's fire. Where there's racially disparate outcomes, racial bias has something to do with it. And we often lean to the inequities that are the role of the community or the role of the student in not being able to perform. We rarely look at the system to say the system is producing these outcomes. And so one point in case, in terms of second generation segregation, that's schools within schools where you have tracking of you know, middle to high income white and black and brown students in a particular course or a magnet program, and then everyone else who's not in the magnet program, they are then on a different track, which are typically low income black and brown students. And so this is a systemic issue in terms of access to higher quality education. So this is not a natural occurrence. These students who are low-income black and brown students are not less intelligent. They have less access. And at what point does that start? And how do we then intervene? Because what we do know in these low-income black and brown schools is that they have a less experienced teaching force, higher teacher turnover rates, and less experienced leaders. Now, this is a systemic issue that unless we pay attention and solve that issue, they're not receiving the same education as their brothers and sisters, the white and middle to high-income white students that are in these middle of the high income schools where they have longer standing teachers and a more experienced teaching force.
And part of the reason for that turnover, et cetera, is that in your high poverty schools, you will find that teachers and the school staff had less autonomy in deciding what is best for these children at this particular school. What's the equity that we need for these children at this particular school? So they become frustrated and leave, or we're not working together to solve issues at that particular school.
Is that because of a top-down, one-size-fits-all approach divorced from racism? It's just this is how we're going to do it system-wide, or is it because of racism?
It is because of systemic racism that says, okay, we're going to tell y'all what to do and how to do it over here, but we're going to give you all, because you're low poverty, high achieving, autonomy to do. And so then that reeks into what teachers believe.
And how should it be handled? Because obviously this has been going on not just in this system but around the country, and what you're saying is that when legislators and administrators see low-performing schools, they instantly blame the teacher.
Exactly.
And the teacher is all control of how they teach and what they teach and how they talk to those kids goes out the window, and it's prescribed.
Exactly.
Whereas if you're in a high-performance school, the teacher must be doing something right, so leave them alone. So how do you fix that?
We fix that by bringing that equity committee right into the school itself and saying, let's get the students, the parents, the teachers and administrators together, and let's look at all aspects of our school. and then we can promote to you we need.
Let me flip the question around. If we have these low-performing schools where the kids aren't doing well, and we are not supposed to blame the teacher because it's not their fault, and we're not supposed to tell the teacher how to teach because they know how to teach these kids, why haven't they been doing it?
Well, I think the broader question, and one, I love all my teachers out there working right now very hard every day. My son's a senior in high school, and he's in his math class right now. So, you know, love and shout out to all teachers and educators out there. So we're not bashing teachers, we're not bashing educators. But what we do need to understand is that we're in a system where we have labeled and we've really disenfranchised underachieving schools and underachieving students, that we spend millions of dollars on measuring the problem rather than solving the problem. In what realm is it okay to say, we know where the issues are, we know that this school is struggling, but yet we're going to spend $1 million on testing rather than taking that money and spending it on resources? We know where the issues are. We know it's been in these schools historically. So why do we need to spend any more money on measuring it, take that same pot of money and spend it on a solution?
No, this is not your decision to make, Frank, but you're in the system and you're an administrator in the system. Is this how people in the system at your level feel about this? Is this coming from on high, from the legislature or elsewhere? Or are people within CMS and other public school systems caught up in this same philosophy that Tracy just talked about?
I think we're all grappling with what's the best way to help make our educational system come up to the ideals that we've articulated, or at least some founders articulated. So whether it was legal accountability, whether it's been testing accountability, whether it's been identifying what's loose and tight, meaning what are things that you're free to decide and what are things you're not free to decide. Those are things that are national conversations. They're not just local or statewide conversations.
35 superintendents ago, but this is back in the Heath Morrison era.
Mike, that's not right.
But back in the Heath Morrison era, CMS considered hiring the educational consultant that wrote the foreword to this man's book over here, Glenn Singleton. And evidently, he was going to come in and help people recognize racial bias. And it raised such a furor within the district that they decided against hiring him. Instead, they began quietly doing what they call cultural competency training. And that was before the Leading on Opportunity report identified school segregation as one of the problems that leads to the lack of upward mobility in Charlotte. So now that we know that from the Leading on Opportunity study, have we focused on fixing this problem? Have schools stepped up their efforts to recognize racial bias and the outcomes of unrecognized racial bias on these kids' lives?
All 178 schools haven't taken on this mantle with the same level of vigor and intensity. Some schools have certainly done it, and it's been due to their school-based leadership, the teacher leaders and the administrators in those buildings. It's something that we're continually working on. I was here with those 35 superintendents ago with Dr. Morrison, and those were difficult conversations. I think where we perhaps can get closer is having these conversations about race and racism and how they directly translate in how we teach students. I have to say I was a little bit distracted during our conversation because an email came up from a student and I was looking over your shoulder.
I'll read it for you because you can see my screen.
I could. I was distracted.
You're sneaky, aren't you? Hello, my name is Jordan. I'm a 7th grade homeschool student, but I was in CMS for my whole life before this year. My question is, why do teachers treat black people differently from other students?
And I want to give one response to that, but not the only response. But I thought it was fascinating that a student sent that in. And I wanted to speak
well,
to...
Well, we assume it's a student.
We assume it's
a student.
I wanted to say to Jordan, whoever Jordan is I think we don't always need to see different as worse. I think we never want to treat everyone the same. What we want to do is we want to cultivate the unique gifts and talents of every student, but we want to make sure that in treating students differently, that we interrupt practices that create, sustain, or reproduce disparities, and that in doing so that we want to eliminate the predictability of who achieves academically. So I would encourage Jordan to say sometimes some students are treated differently, but I would dare to say that Erlene, who was a master teacher, treated some students differently, and it wasn't for the worse. all the time. But I think in some instances, what he might be talking about is bias, is low expectations, is harsher disciplinary responses to the same type of student behavior. Right. I think those are some biases, but I do want to challenge that different is always worse.
So one of the points that you make in your book, Tracy, is that for a lot of white people, the subject of race is taboo, so we don't talk about it. It's certainly uncomfortable, and it's dangerous to talk about it sometimes. I mean, you're going to offend people, or you run the risk of doing it. But you say, you believe, talking about it should be a normal, everyday practice. That's a topic for another show, how we make that happen. Tracy Benson, author of Unconscious Bias in Schools, Janine Bryant with CREED, Erlene Lyle, Lied with the CMS Association of Educators, and Frank Barnes with CMS. Thank you all. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, dedicated to those who believe a car should stir one's emotions and deliver a heightened state of driving. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com.